You've been rather mischievous, Kat.
I have not. I admit nothing.
You have. You've been spreading misleading polls.
Oh, all right. Okay. Yeah, all right. No, that I do admit to. I suppose I have.
Yes, at the end of last year, the lawyer, or you, posted a poll on LinkedIn where four major law firm merger rumours were on there, and one of them was a fake pairing, and you put that out there to spread misinformation. Well, actually, to be fair, we wanted to see whether readers could spot what was the fake rumour and what wasn't, and what was the current gossip making the rounds. And over 1,000 readers voted, and, you know, credit where it's due, 42%, you know, the largest answer, correctly identified the fake rumour that Ashurst might merge with Burgess Salmon.
Yes, and I was massively disappointed with that, because I think Ashurst and Burgess Salmon should be talking to each other. Now, the other pairings that we posted were all live rumours, but they were all transatlantic deals. And the reason that I still propose the Ashurst-Burgess-Salmon rumour is because national mergers are more likely to happen than international, and we do have evidence for that, which I'm not going to go into, but anyway. But actually, funnily enough, the rumour that Hogan Lovells is in talks with Sherman and Sterling, was actually dismissed as fake by a third of our readers.
Yeah, it was the next most answered answer, wasn't it? So everyone thought that was really unlikely. And I mean, to be fair, although it's such a popular rumour now, it did surprise us at the time when we first heard it. But look, let's get on with it, because we'll be diving into that later in the podcast.
And for now, I'm Katrin Griffiths, editor of The Lawyer.
I'm Christian Smith, the litigation editor at The Lawyer.
And welcome to The Lawyer podcast. We are back for 2023, and we have all we know about the Hogan Lovells, Sherman and Sterling merger rumours later in the podcast with our deputy editor, City, Rachel Maloney.
Our other deputy editor of National, Richard Simmons, will also be with us to discuss what Gen Z lawyers, or law students rather, might want out of their legal career.
And also on this episode, I'm going to be speaking to Hill Dickinson partner Jessica Neary, who last week was accused by a fellow parent at the school pickup that she was an absent mother. So we're going to be discussing what it's like to be a firm partner and a mother, and how it's often other parents who are the most judgmental when it comes to those who try to have a career and be a parent at the same time.
But first, it is one of our most popular features every year, and this week, The Lawyer released its top 20 cases for 2023. Now, the sift through the quite frankly extraordinary entries was done by the litigation team of Adam Awadi, Maria Ward-Brennan, Annabelle Tinson, and myself. And Adam, our senior litigation reporter, joins us now to discuss the list. Adam, tell us what the top 20 cases is all about.
So yeah, thanks Christian, thanks for having me back on the podcast. So basically, the top 20 cases is the definitive list of this year's biggest courtroom battles, selected from submissions from almost every major law firm and commercial chambers in England. And the flagship annual feature contains all you need to know about the hottest disputes, which should be on every litigator's radar, including the full list of lawyers and barristers instructed for each dispute.
Yeah, so let's have a look at some of the big numbers for the top 20 list. Appearing, you've got 41 chambers, 45 law firms, 192 barristers, including 85 silks, and then 86 law firm partners. Now, we don't really have time to go through all of the cases in the top 20, but Adam, you've picked out one of your favourites, I think. What's that?
Well, one of my highlights is a case which we've covered before at The Lawyer, and also on the hearing. It's the case brought by the London International Exhibition Centre, also known as the Excel Centre. It's a East London conference exhibition centre, which was temporarily used as a Nightingale Hospital during 2020. They're bringing a £16 million case against six insurers, including Allianz, Zurich and RSA Insurance, for lockdown losses after it was temporarily shut and transformed into the Nightingale Hospital. They are relying on an insurance clause covering occurrences of diseases at the premises, and the insurers are rejecting it, denying it. They say that the venue was repurposed, it wasn't closed. But basically, it's the latest lawsuit brought by a business against insurers over their indemnity clauses, which wasn't resolved by the Supreme Court in the 2020 ruling, which was a landmark ruling in favour of policyholders in a case brought by the Financial Conduct Authority. it's worth noting that, like last year, in the cases brought by Stonegate, various eateries, and Greggs, the High Court is bunching the claims brought by Excel together with other claims brought by other businesses. It's one to watch. I mean, there will come a point where policyholders run out of different types of insurance cases to test. But until then, it's going to be keeping lawyers very busy.
Yeah, I think probably one of the ones that I'm watching most closely is the tuna bonds or hidden debt scandal, which is, you know, a case that I think many listeners will be familiar with. It's been around for a decade now, but it basically involves the country of Mozambique, and they are represented by Peters and Peters and an enormous team of barristers, and they're bringing a case against a number of companies, including enormous banking giants like Credit Suisse and the Russian bank VTB, about incidents involving alleged bribery and fraud back in 2013 and 14 to do with the Mozambique tuna fishing industry, and the kind of consequences of the alleged fraud and bribery in this case was that it pushed about 2 million people in Mozambique into poverty and cost the country around about $11 billion. The claim itself is worth around including counterclaims on each side, is worth around $4 billion. So it's quite extraordinary. Almost as extraordinary as that, though, is just the number and the scale of the case and the number of lawyers. So there are 52 lawyers on this case alone. That's not even including associates. And so you've got around about 14 KCs, including that. I mean, there are a large number of parties involved in the case, but it is quite extraordinary just how many lawyers are going to be on this case. It's going to be a bit of a case of musical chairs in the court on day one, I think, which will be something to see. That's going to be in October.
It's funny you mentioned that, Christian, because, it is hard to choose your favourite case of the top 20 cases because they're all so interesting. But I think one of the themes running through the tuna bond case, as well as many others, the ex F1, the HMRC's case against ex F1 boss Bernie Eccleston, the retrial involving two men accused of bribing Saudi officials, and many more, is that they all involve fraud allegations. And as you expect, with the looming recession, this is probably just the beginning of such cases. Indeed, it's one of the five market trends that the lawyer believes will define 2023. I mean, economic disruption or hardship typically means more economic crime, largely because either the declining economy exposes white-collar and financial crimes that buoyant times previously concealed, or because the incentives to commit such crime grow as hardship worsens. I think fraud would back the forefront of discussion is because increased enforcements and fines are key to the Financial Conduct Authority's new three-year strategy to reduce and prevent serious harm to consumers and markets. And the new Serious Fraud Office heads, Lisa Ossofsky is stepping down later this year. The new head could signal a new era for the deeply challenged regulator. And don't take it just from us, really. I mean, just have a scan through the lawyer's live moves blog. I mean, it reveals the past year has seen law firms steadily boosting their white-collar business crime and fraud reserves.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think it's probably worth noting that I think a lot of these cases in the top 20 are kind of, you know, not already coming out of the recession. I mean, some of them are many years old. But I think that, you know, if you're sitting there thinking, oh, well, you know, this is the peak of the fraud cases, I don't think so. I think it's only going to get, you know, more and more prominent over the coming few years. I think, you know, as well, these cases are... We've got a huge number of entries, and, you know, these cases that made it into the top 20 are kind of career-defining cases for many of the lawyers involved. They're kind of what people got into the law to be a part of. So it's really exciting. Adam, thank you very much for coming on and talking about that. And make sure you head to thelawyer.com to check out the other top 20 cases in the list.
Last week, Hill Dickinson partner Jessica Neary put up a post on LinkedIn in which she recounted an experience she'd had at the school gate. She was collecting her son at 3 o'clock rather than from the after-school club. And while she was picking him up, another parent called her, quote, an absent mother. Now, that LinkedIn post was particularly noteworthy because of the volume of response that she had. And we have Jessica here with us. Jessica, talk us through what you expected when you put up the original post.
I'm not sure that I expected anything, to be honest. I just was frankly shocked that another mother publicly shamed me. And I just thought, as a working parent, it's just so important to recognise, I think, that everybody is really just juggling and doing their best, and to be sort of called out for that, I just thought it was unacceptable, which is what prompted me to put up the post. But yeah, I was shocked by the response. So I think it's coming close to 3,000 likes and about 300 comments, which for me is unusual.
Yeah, I mean, the comments are extraordinary. I mean, the number of other working mothers who have had a similar sort of experience, and it's I suppose the sort of, it shows there's a sort of an untapped kind of tension there, isn't there, sort of both at the school gate but also to some extent actually the balancing of that work and life responsibilities that you have. Were you, when you read through those comments, I mean, there's sort of, you know, I urge anyone to look for Jessica's LinkedIn post, actually. The comments were really quite heartfelt, some of them. Were any that struck you in particular?
Definitely. So I think one of the mums, who I think actually is based in America and is a lawyer, was called a Friday mum because she only ever picked her kids up on a Friday. And there was another one who was effectively banned from running the tombola organized by the PTA because she wasn't a proper mum because she also had a job. I mean, there was just hundreds, and all very similar. Some of them were from quite a few years ago, but a lot of them are really recent, which just goes to show that society's, you know, opinion on working mothers has not really changed as much as we thought it, we like to think that it had.
It's particularly interesting as well because, you know, when we talk about parents in the workplace, we obviously look at it through the lens of the workplace, but there's also this sense, isn't there, that there are external factors that actually create kind of currents of emotion and currents of perhaps guilt. You know, the phrase mummy guilt was mentioned quite a lot in the comments to your post as well, and there are these sort of external factors that actually play into people's own individual decisions about whether they work, whether they go part-time, whether they take time off or have a career break or whatever. Is that something that you think that this actually spotlighted?
Definitely. So I think the reason that people return to work, you know, well, there are so many reasons, aren't there? Financial, but also I wanted to go back to work after maternity leave. I really like being a lawyer. It's a massive part of my identity. And so to be made to feel guilty for that, I just think is unacceptable, frankly. And I also think, you know, we're bringing up girls and boys and we want to show them that it's not just dad who goes to work or the man, but actually anybody, you could just do what you want, and that's great. And we should champion that.
Yeah, certainly. There's no equivalent of daddy guilt, really. I mean, there may be, but it's not a sort of a huge thing in the way that mummy guilt, I think, is sort of exists. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on the Lawyer Podcast, and good luck with your next school pickup.
A new survey of undergraduate law students from law firm Birkitts has found that despite popular opinion to the contrary, Gen Z's future lawyers are just as interested in profitability and prestige as other generations. Richard Simmons joins us. He's the Lawyer's Deputy Editor of National and also formerly the Editor of the Lawyer's Student Coverage. Richard, what exactly did we learn from the survey?
Well, I think one of the things we learned was that, yes, students are in many, many ways very, very different from previous generations that have come before them. It would be useless to deny that. But equally, they're also kind of the same. Let's be honest, law students are a breed, and it's ever been thus. And they are driven, dedicated, ambitious, and they want to get on in life and in their career.
And what actually were sort of some of the prime motivators here? I think sort of prestige is one of them. Money is another. Talk us through some of the findings of the survey, Rich.
Yeah, actually, so for students wanting to choose law in the first place, it's all the usual things that you might expect. Top of the list actually comes job security. And I guess that's no surprise given the economic circumstances we live in and have lived in for the past decade. Second was they enjoy negotiation. Again, hardly surprising
one
that
a
legal career is top of their list for that reason. And then third came financial rewards. Slightly further down, I want to help people. Slightly further down again, I want to be a part in driving justice. So those sort of more perhaps idealistic attributes are still there, but they're further down than those classic, ultimately, job security is what drives people.
I suppose what's really clearly not on the list is innovation and disruption. And innovation and disruption are the sort of two terms that have been bandied about, you know, sort of in the law, but not an awful lot to show for it yet. Do you think that that's something to do with the sort of simply the character of the people who come into the law to start with?
I do think that probably is true. I think what is also true is that there will always be a minor sector of that cohort who really do have that innovative streak in them. And so law will still be able to pick up a few of those, but perhaps it should be thinking better about how to attract that type of student.
So all the stuff that everyone talks about, like dogs in the workplace and, you know, wanting to finish at 5:30 and that sort of thing, are we saying that that's rubbish, or are we saying that...
No, not at all. I think that...
Thank goodness.
Yeah, we all love a dog, although we can't have any in this office,
no,
can we?
Can't.
Allergies. These things are very important. And clearly, in a new environment post-pandemic, there are choices to be made about how we work now. And that's not going to go away. But I think certainly dogs in the office compared to working on the best, most exciting deals of the time, there's no comparison, is there? And there seems to be an increasing choice that has to be made between, are you a firm that gives out the money and the big bucks, or are you a firm that goes heavy down the lifestyle route, shall we say? And we've seen some firms really sort of diverging in both of those directions at the moment. But you've also got to tread the tightrope a bit, haven't you? Because if you go too far in one direction, you're going to lose some students who you might have wanted, actually.
I just wanted to add, I like how down the very bottom of the options is who will take me, whoever will take me. Which, to be fair, I mean that would have been me. So I mean, I feel like if honesty was at the top here,
well,
you'd say probably that'd be a bit higher.
It is interesting because there is another result in this survey, let me dig it out, which says half, 50% of UK-based second and third year undergraduates surveyed apply to 3 or 4 law firms for training contracts, which seems an awfully low number. I've spoken to many trainees over the years who applied for, you know, put in 50 application forms before they got that coveted job offer. Whoever will take me is, you know, still going to be a big factor.
Well, maybe the people who are sort of saying whoever will take me to apply to more firms, frankly.
Absolutely, yeah.
Lovely. Well, thanks for joining, Rich.
Thank you.
Now, as we flagged at the beginning of the show, rumours are flying about what would be a major global merger between 2 US firms with significant London offices. The UK's fourth largest firm, Hogan Lovells, and Sherman and Sterling. And with me here is Rachel Maloney, our deputy editor of City, and she has joined us with all of the insight and all of the goss. Now, Rachel, what do we know so far?
Sherman, we've been looking at this firm for a while. People have definitely been talking about it quite a lot. And there's been specifically merger talk for also quite a while. I think they've maybe had a few conversations with a number of firms, but it's Hogan Lovells that has emerged as the one that they're granted early stage talks with at the moment. I think Sherman's maybe been pondering its overall strategy, and that's why it's kind of having these talks with firms at the moment.
And it's come from Sherman is coming from a position of relative weakness compared to Hogan Lovells, is it not?
It is. I mean, so in terms of profits, actually, Sherman Sherman's profits are actually higher than Hogan Lovells, but I think that's because Hogan Lovells is just so much bigger, and when you get to a certain size, you know, you do have to deal with those dilution of profitability issues. That's not to say Hogan Lovells doesn't pay its people well. Its PEP is at the last count around, it's over $2 million, which is obviously very good.
I think that's called respectable only in the States, isn't it? The profit per equity partner of $2 million. Yeah,
2 million, it could be $5 million. Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, from that point of view, Sherman's profits are better. But Hogan Lovells is definitely cruising along a lot better than Sherman, where we've, you know, heard about several roadblocks. A bumpy road, some might say, at the moment. It's lost quite a few people in London recently, especially some hires that haven't really been there for that long, including Helena Potts, who's going to Paul Hastings. And there was also, she's in restructuring, and there was another restructuring partner that joined from Akin Gump and then went back to Akin Gump after about 18 months. So that doesn't give the impression of a stable ship. Whereas Hogan Lovells has been hiring. People generally stay. I wrote a Horizon about this the other week, actually, where newly promoted partners don't really leave, if you look at the data. So, yeah, there's lots of positives about Hogan Lovells. It's a much more stable ship than Sherman at the moment.
Yeah, certainly. And I think you get that feeling, don't you, that Hogan Lovells, there's a sort of solidity about it because it had such a, you know, it was a legacy UK practice in Lovells. So it has that sort of ballast, if you like. Sherman & Sterling has had a very febrile kind of few years. I think it's worth pointing out to listeners, although we look at it obviously from the London angle because that's where we're based and they are huge businesses over here. They employ a lot of people. However, this is fundamentally a US deal, isn't it? You know, I think for quite a lot of the US partners, London is pretty irrelevant to their calculations about whether, you know, sort of a merger between a national firm with big regulatory practice and a sort of a New York focused, finance focused firm like Sherman will fly.
Yeah, I don't really think partners in Hogan Lovells London are really going to be thinking about the addition. I mean, Sherman has 30 partners in London, so, and Hogan Lovells has well over 100 more. So, you know, it's an acquisition essentially in London. And it kind of is in the US as well, because if you look at the offices, which I did, Hogan Lovells is based in loads more places. It's got 12 more US offices than Sherman. So, you know, that Hogan Lovells has it over in US in lots of places like Baltimore, Monterey, you know, it's they're already there. Mm. I don't know whether Sherman wants to be there, but
I don't think it's got much choice. I think in this, I think there's a sort of, and that actually, that applies, I think, to London, doesn't it? You know, because of this heritage. And actually, Hogan Lovells' European footprint is very, very secure as well. I mean, Hogan Lovells has an absolutely full service practice in London, but in Sherman, with Sherman, it's absolutely not like that. It's very, very narrow, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Sherman and Hogan Lovells were actually in quite a few of the same European places. I guess there's, if you're a US firm, you definitely focus on New York and Washington. And then if you're in other places, that just means you want to do more of the domestic work, I guess. Whereas in Europe, it's kind of given that you want to be in London and Paris and places in Germany. It's quite interesting for Hogan Lovells in that the significant thing that Sherman has in the US that Hogan Lovells doesn't have is more offices in Texas. So if Hogan Lovells wants to get more energy clients, which Sherman, I think, is more kind of known for in terms of the energy and the projects work, then that would be good. Although we've also been hearing that maybe Sherman's gone too big in Texas. Maybe it's three offices was too much.
So I think there's lots and lots to play for here. What's your guess, Rachel? Is this gonna move to a vote? What do we think?
My guess. Oh, you've got me there. It's really hard to say because A&O and O'Malvany is ringing in my head, and there was just too many different things to look at. You've got to look at culture, which I think is a massive thing. Hogan Lovells has a culture that people seem to really like, and I'm not sure at the moment if that would match up with Sherman, but do I think it will go the way? I'm going to say no, but then that was going to bite me back. So we'll see.
We will return to this topic, I think, over the next coming months. Rachel, thank you so much.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of The Lawyer Podcast.
Thank you for listening. You can contact us at podcast@thelawyer.com. And of course, you can find more about everything we've been discussing at thelawyer.com.
We'll be back again in a fortnight. But until then, goodbye.